Welcome to the Strong Source Commodity Podcast. We are your hosts, Martijn Bron and Alexander Sterk.
Good afternoon. Well, welcome, listeners, to the Commodity Podcast that we have done now 5 times. It's the Strong Source Commodity Podcast for the regular listeners. And today we are very happy to welcome Ben Takke, Global Procurement and Trading Director of De Huis Animal Feed. And I know Ben for a very long time because we worked together in Cargill when we were trading grains and oilseeds. And both of us, we went to Geneva. So we were a team of 4 at the time responsible for the European oilseeds trading book. And that was a move to Geneva. And I vividly recall basically the first night that we arrived in Geneva and that we both checked in our apartments. And they were the typical Cargill apartments, Romanian style, very, very ugly.
Nice and cozy.
But yeah, that was the beginning of a fantastic period for me, 3 years, for Ben longer, where we had a little bit of the high roller life in Geneva, lots of skiing, weekends away, trading with the best and the brightest. Yeah, we became friends along the way. So I'm very happy, Ben, that you are here and that you take us through your impressive trading career.
Yeah, welcome, Ben. I'm very happy that you're here. Not to just to talk about the skiing activities that you guys had.
And talk about it for a very, very long period.
We can do that well, ski podcast with all the guys that were in Geneva. Because a lot of traders were probably in Geneva sometime in their career. So maybe we could talk about skiing or the fun life in Geneva. But let's skip that for another podcast. Welcome, Ben. Super happy here. Yeah, tell us about your career so far. I mean,
where to start? It started, like Martijn was already saying, in Amsterdam with Cargill. And I remember quite vividly when I arrived for an interview in Amsterdam. It was in the outskirt of the harbor in a horrible office. So I came in and what I saw was basically 30 guys just shouting and very excited about their markets, and went for an interview, and I think it went well. And I got back home and I remember my former girlfriend at the time saying, "So, Ben, what do you think?" I said, "Well, I don't know exactly what I'm going to do, but this is really something fantastic. This is what I want to do." So that's where it started. And from there, I worked there for 4 years. And then with the team, we went to Geneva. It was all still on the agricultural side, oil seeds, the oils, the meals, and so forth. And then, they asked me to look into biodiesel. And then biodiesel at that time was relatively new. And to understand it, and that's something I think within trading, you will always see that to really understand, you have to dive into these markets. So I dove also into the diesel market, the mineral oil diesel side of things. And I noticed it was so much bigger than the biofuels at the time. So I said, well, to really understand that, you really have to understand something about the energy side as well. So I got a bit more interested in the energy side and decided to switch. Cargill at that time set up a call desk. They asked me to join. I joined. It was brand new. So it's just 4 people, basically nothing than hopefully good ideas. Yeah, did that for a couple of years. And then being in that market, I also noticed that, has a lot of links with other markets. So I started at that time, it called the convergence desk, which basically was, you can trade all the products that we do, that they traded within Cargill, because these products, they all have links with one another. So for example, you have ethanol, gasoline, corn, crude. It's kind of a box that influence one another. Same for coal, freight, iron ore, and so forth. And if there's one trading house that at that time could provide those products, it was Cargill. We started to do that, and that was quite interesting. And there was also quite some interest from the pension funds. They wanted to lift on the back of Cargill ideas, commodity ideas. So they gave us additional VAR, pension funds from Holland, but also from the US. So we did that for nearly 2 years. And then my wife at that time, we had 2 kids living in Geneva. She wanted to go back to Holland. And I told her in the beginning, it's fine, but there's nothing to do for me in Holland because there's not that many commodity trading houses. And so, what to do? And then Osprey, a small hedge fund, started a branch in Europe. And this was a commodity hedge fund run by people sitting in New York. It was really based on analytics. And that I liked, with a fundamental background. I liked that angle.
Yep.
So I decided to join. It was just the head of 1 other guy and myself. So basically nothing. So when I was actually moving in August 2008, and you can already here the date, the financial crisis started, and one of the triggers was Lehman Brothers, and this hedge fund, Osprey, was 30% funded by Lehman Brothers. So they pulled the trigger because their funders hit the threshold, I think it was 30% down. So they pulled the trigger, and which also meant that Osprey in Holland stopped to exist. And at that time, the guy running it said, okay, Ben, we can try and see if we can find funding. But okay, this is September 2008, and everybody's... forget about it. Everybody was looking to get rid of risk instead of to take on risk. So before I joined Osprey, I had also some talks in Holland with the usual suspects, Glencore, Vattenfall, Cargill, based in Rotterdam and Amsterdam. So basically after a couple of weeks, I called them, and one of them said, well, basically, Ben, I was expecting your call. And this was the guy heading the Vattenfall training floor, at that time still Nuon. And he offered me, he said, well, we're looking for someone for the gas book. I had no real experience in gas. Yeah, maybe a bit in convergence trading with Cargill, but basically none. So I told him, okay, instead of trading one product, I would prefer to trade all the products that you are trading as a sort of an internal small hedge fund, purely spec. And that's what I've started doing in the beginning on my own. And we ended with the four of us in a small team. And we did that 4.5 years. And then I'm not saying it was not interesting, because it was, but it was basically just pushing buttons and watching screens. So really glued behind 8 screens, the four of us, watching the prices move all day. I basically missed a bit the physical part of the trading, and I was at that time was a headhunter, an old Cargill guy, Willem Mok. You might probably recall the guy. Yeah. And we had lunch, once every 3 months, once every 6 months. And he said, "Well, there's a small feed company at that time, the Heus, and they're looking for a head of." Basically, wasn't that small, but okay, it was still relatively small, looking for a head of procurement and trading with a not procurement head on, but a head of experience in trading. So I went over and had a chat with, at that time, the father of the, well, still the father, but the head of the company, and his 2 sons, which were running it. And yeah, it triggered me. You know, they were in the right places. They were present in Brazil. They were in big in Europe. They were in Asia. They were physically present with a lot of different agri markets, but also in future markets. And I said, well, I'm just going to do it. And it meant starting to manage a team instead of 4, but a lot bigger.
Was it a difficult step to take, because you did before that, you did spec, you did more the actual trading, now you get more to the fiscal side. Was that because I think more people have this in the trading, that they go from either purely screen trading to maybe fiscal or the other way around. What's the difficult part about making that step, basically?
I had the experience within Cargill from the fiscal side. So for me, it was a bit going back into the old world.
Just longer back.
Longer back. But I would say that the main difference is it's you have a bit more, I'm not saying room for error, you don't, but it's you have a bit more room to maneuver. It's like having an additional tool to play. The future market, it's very pure and clean. Yeah. It's right or wrong. So you're long and the market goes down, you're wrong. And the market goes up and you're, and as soon as you get out, that's the result that you make. Yeah. And in physical markets compared to the future market and being able to do both of them, there's the basis level in between, which also absorbs some of that volatility of the future markets.
But you at the Heus, did you work, because you do procurement and trading, did you work from a long or a short then? Because you can do both basically, right?
Yeah.
Normally a producer is always building out from a long.
Yeah. The way I always look at it is the first month is basically locked in margin. So everything that I've bought is also sold, so that margin is locked in. And then the 2-3 months that I would, let's say, buy corn, that is length that a competitor has as well. So when the markets go down, we're both wrong, and we both hurt, their P&L are red, and so is mine. Anything more than that, I call outright spec or outright positions, because we are a family company, so we don't need to report. It doesn't mean that you have to be very conscious with risk. It still means you, but you have to be very conscious. But we are a bit more free in the way that we take on positions versus a listed company, for example. It's difficult for a listed company to weather extreme commodity swings. I look at dairy, for example. It's basically there, it's a lot more margin business. Instead of.
But happy you made the jump.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, it grew very quickly. This is set 10 years now, and basically we more than tripled in size and a lot more countries added to the list. Yeah, so it's gone from, I would say, mid-sized to one of the bigger international companies in Holland. And if you look at the list globally, we're, I think, number 6 or 7 at the moment. So growing quickly.
And how would you describe the culture in your team, specifically in your team, regarding the trading and people that you look for?
Now, what I strive for is open communication. So people need to, as soon as they buy something, we put it on an app or you call one another. If something is bought in Vietnam, we need to hear it. So we can calculate it back to what the price would be in Holland or in South Africa or in Egypt or whatever country. And by creating that open communication, you have a lot of market leverage. So being in 21 countries, having procurement teams in all these countries gives you a very large geographical presence with all different kind of angles of whether it's logistics, weather, local weather, local crops, and all that information we try to combine in one global team based in Holland and based in Vietnam. So that team is a bit more focused on analytics and risk management, I would say. And then the local teams are focused on making sure the factories run and making sure the logistics, admin, everything is done. But you have to combine all that information. I think that really is the cherry on the cake in the physical trading side or physical procurement side.
Ben, maybe you don't recall, but I left Geneva a bit earlier and I moved from grains and oilseeds to cocoa and I didn't know anything. And discussions I have with candidates or with clients is often about to what extent people can move from one commodity to another. Now, and I always give myself as an example that it is certainly possible. But when I started in cocoa, I struggled big time. And then you and I, the first 6 months, and then you were in Amsterdam for a weekend. And we met at the chocolate bar in the pipe. Coincidence. And I said to you, look, I'm lost. And I felt like a striker out of shape. And we had a good conversation. And you and I, we came to the conclusion that I should just keep on going. And it could not be that I could no longer trade, right? It was just a matter of, and indeed, after 6 months, I understood the dramatic difference between the markets that we were used to. So mostly Chicago border trade, very well organized, versus at the time, the live cocoa markets, which were a disaster, where we're constantly squeezed. But if I look at your profile, you traded many different commodities, and that's very impressive. So I think what is interesting for our listeners, how did you so easily move from one commodity to another and from screen trading to physical risk management, pure proprietary trading? It's an indication of agility, learning agility and curiosity, which is critical for traders, which you master. But can you share with the listeners a bit how you managed to get in shape very quickly?
Are you maybe then a commodity chameleon?
But so how do you do that? So you move from one commodity to another. How do you get in shape quickly to master the commodity, the contracts, the network, the complexities, all those things?
It's a very good question. And I think the background, the Cargill background, being almost 9 years, 10 years at Cargill, was, I think, gives you a very good fundamental background. And I think that is whichever commodity you look into, going back to these fundamentals is very important. I think that school is very important. And then for me, the second big school was in Vattenfall, because S&Ds did not really exist in power or in gas at that time. Maybe now they do, I'm not sure, but at that time we didn't have them. So you go back to, because like you say, you feel a bit lost, right? So you go back to creating something that feels certain for yourself, which at that time was a bit more the technical side of trading. So you start looking more at price movements and so forth. So that gave me a bit more stability in that market, but you could still combine it with your physical and fundamental views. So when things did not make sense for me, for example, certain spreads, then I would say, let's put these spreads on. And because this is too low of a number, at this number.
See the result of the spread and see if it works.
Yeah, right. And spreads are always, can be kind of difficult, because they can be underwater for a very long period before they finally adjust. Factories can run under their cost price for a long time before they actually go out of production. But so there you have the link. So you have the link between the physical side, which the fundamental side, which I learned, I think, within Cargill, and then the more technical side, which I learned more in the energy markets. And I think that last bit, that the technical side, gave me a lot more stability, I would say.
And the technical side, is that applicable on all physical commodities, do you think?
Not purely on physical, but on futures, yes.
Futures.
So there you can really look at the technicals. I never look at those in just as one item that is going to make or break this market. It's just one part of the puzzle. So you need to combine all these pieces, and then when they are a bit aligned, you can take a position, or you can take a big position where you're really certain of yourself.
Because a lot of the commodities, they don't have futures, right?
No, exactly.
So,
Yeah. So at the moment, for example, the main products that we trade are corn, wheat, soya, soy meal, soy oil, matif, rape seeds, and these products that have relatively liquid future markets that can make it so we can hedge.
Fiscal settlements.
Yeah, they have, yeah, exactly. So that is a bit more, that's different than the energy market, where they were financially settled.
Do you have a preference for what's your personal preference, which commodity after all these years?
Good question.
Which one is like your little baby? And you, Martijn, you as well? Right? Is it cocoa? Is it oil seeds? What is it?
It's a good question.
Now, look.
I had a good of experience in all these markets, and they were very good ones, but there were also very tough ones.
Yeah.
And I think the tough ones were also a lot of fun, in hindsight.
I think it's a very interesting question. And I have, along the way, I've enjoyed cocoa. But the difficulty about that market is that it is often, it's a casino. It's like a runaway market. Yeah, it's very technical.
Sounds like a scary market to be in.
And things that happen that have nothing to do with fundamentals. And a niche environment where some people are prepared to blow themselves up. Yeah, now that I found difficult to cope with. Because if you have almost psychopaths, right, who want to make a point to have everyone end up in a misery.
But they were financially sound enough to
that. Some have really blown up, and hence the expression cocoa graveyard. But what I liked, for example, about Sun, when we were trading Sun, we could run massive positions in Sun Oil. There is no future in Sun Oil, but we were so convinced, and you referred to it.
Sunflower oil, you mean.
We were so convinced about our S&Ds, and at the time, we made the S&Ds together. Because he was doing the seeds and I was doing the oil. So we were going through the nitty-gritty of these S&Ds and every cell we knew. And if we did not know a cell in the S&D, that was also information. So we have made good money in trading Sun Oil. And it wasn't necessarily easy, but when we were convinced about the fundamentals, it was more easy to trade size and also trade size through turbulence. And physical markets, you can't easily squeeze. Futures markets, you can really squeeze. So if I look back at it,
Which reason is your favorite?
Sun, I've really enjoyed a lot. And the origins, like Argentina, Russia, Ukraine, at that time were not as complicated, for example, as West Africa. But cocoa is a different animal, but I've learned a huge amount there as well. You learn something from every market, right?
Yeah, sure.
And look, when you were trading coal, it's also an interesting topic. And we talked about it with, I think it was with Boudewijn or with Dan, about how you operate in a team. Sometimes on a desk, you trade per committee, which is different. Yeah, that was with Boudewijn, when you trade alone. Now, and I recall that we had some discussions at the time when you were trading coal, that at the time the head of coal was a bit risk averse versus you guys. Can you share a bit how you guys managed that?
Yeah, I'm not sure whether it's really risk averse, but I think it was more his role in the team was also to be more risk averse. I think that is also, if you have a team, it's the role of the trader to take that risk, and he's paid for taking that risk.
Yeah.
And it's the role of the manager to challenge why he's taking risk and ask the right questions, whether the risk that he's taking is valid arguments for it. And at that time, we had nothing, right? There were four people, and there was one physical guy. You had Juan Howlin doing the paper. You had me as a junior, and you had Pat. But we had nothing, so we didn't even have an S&D. Mm. So I built that S&D from scratch together with the analytical team in Geneva at that time. But we had nothing. So, this guy was nervous.
A bit risk averse when the junior is doing the S&D by himself, not with the whole team. I can imagine.
Yeah, exactly. So I think this was also because he didn't feel 100% comfortable. And looking in hindsight, it was very successful.
Yeah.
And maybe because it was in the early stages of that market developing, and that we were, like you say, in Sun Oil or in Sun Seeds, we were also a big part of that market. And we had, we did our homework better than most people, hopefully. But that's why we were able to make some money there. Yeah.
Hey, and how do you do that? Facilitate good traders, young traders, the freedom to operate. So how is your role as a manager? And what did you... That's always interesting. What did you learn from your managers? The good, the bad, and the ugly.
Okay. Well, the first thing, when I joined the Heus, and there was no S&Ds whatsoever. Nobody did that. So there was so much work to be done. Mm. And I think that's has taken years to get that really into every vein of the organization. And so now all the local teams, they work on S&Ds.
Yeah.
And so they at least know the volumes, and when they get challenged by suppliers, at least they know that this is not the last boat that is coming. There will be a next one. But I'm not kidding. There were people that were really afraid, saying, oh, so if we don't have our product on this boat, we will not have any, and the factory won't run. And then you know the S&D is having, there's local products and so forth, and it will not happen. But if you don't have that insight, you just don't know.
Why does that take so long, right? So I think that a lot of trading companies, younger ones, smaller ones that don't have that size of the hose or a cargo, they want to build S&Ds, but you say it takes years before it's in the veins, right? Yeah. So setting up an S&D could be maybe quite quickly, or?
Yeah, you can set it up quite quickly, but then to make it and to prove it by being successful and make and monetize on it, that takes really a while.
That's the time.
That's the time, the craftsmanship to really improve your S&D. Yeah. But I think the other thing is the mindset of people. Mm. And when you are based in Brazil or Vietnam and you've never learned to do that, you really have to. And you cannot hire 100 people in one time. You need to train these people. So I invest a lot in training. Mm. And yeah, that's why it takes a bit more time. And then your second question for me, so what did you learn from? I think in Switzerland, I really learned to have that supply and demand, you know, how important that is for the final price. And that's something it was really in the veins of the people in the WTU team at that time, which was the agricultural cargo trading team. So that's something I really learned and really respected the analytical side of things. And they were so, how do you say?
Rigor
in their information. Yeah. I remember at the end, we had to fill in the prices every night. And if you didn't fill in those price forward curves for the products that you were trading, you were even penalized for it. And if you did do it many, more than, I think, 3 or 4 times, you got penalized on your bonus. So this was really something. It was
drilled into your system.
You had to fill in your prices because that was also where the company money depended on.
Yeah.
So that was something I learned there. And I think in the later stage of my career, I think what I prefer doing is creating this stability by looking always at the same kind of things. So every morning I look at what are the bigger commodities doing. So what is oil doing? What is gold doing? What are the currencies doing? What have the equity done? And then basically my takes only 5 minutes, 10 minutes, but then your day can start. What has China done? And when you do that every day, then certain things start to live their lives, you know what I mean? And then you see changes. So that's something I've learned also from other people, that they were very straight in looking at the same things every day. And so don't switch between different technicals all the time. Take 5, which you constantly follow. Mm. Look at the RSI, look at your MACD, these things, instead of changing them, because there are hundreds. And there was always one that is bearish when you want to be bullish. You know, whatever.
Yeah,
So take 5 and don't move too much around.
I like what you're saying, like, hey, every day, beginning of the day, I watch a few standard big commodities like gold and oil. You do that just to pulse, like, okay, is there something really off of this market or in general?
That's what it is. I try to feel like how's the day? Yeah. And when there's a big change, you know there's something going on somewhere, whether it's oil or gas or big move in Forex. Yeah, there's something has changed. And I'm not saying it's all directly fundamental, but sometimes fundamental things happen and then you have to, you might want to change the position that you have on, or you might be at risk. Like, what was it, 2 years ago with Russia going towards with Ukraine. Yeah. In the beginning, everybody thought, okay, this is probably going to be contained to these two provinces. But then very quickly, it was a fundamental change. And then basically everything changed because this was like the grain provider of the world. So
it will be interesting to see how you two as a duo would have done the S&D for a sunflower, the oil and the seeds in this situation now.
Yeah, basically, first thing we've done, we almost cut it by half. Yeah. So like, this is not going to leave the country. Mm-hmm. And so we were very careful. And then you see over time that people are very creative.
Yeah.
And so you have flows over land, that increased massively. You have smaller
different
boats.
Countries that open up.
Different countries opening up. Yeah.
You get some illegal transport going in and out.
Exactly.
Things like
exactly.
That.
Yeah. But also look at the gas market, where we thought in Europe that we would be completely screwed, to put it mildly, and then we can reduce 20 to 25% of our demand.
Yeah.
just in, yeah, a bit lucky with the milder weather, but still higher prices.
I had very cold at home. I don't know how it was with you guys.
I have three daughters and they were all complaining.
Yeah. It's like, my horrible. Wife turned down everything. Yeah.
Just. But I find it a perfect example of how commodities markets are supposed to work and why you should leave things to the market. And when the European Union came first, the UK, and they came first with a energy price cap.
Yeah.
And that was the collapse of the Truss government.
Yeah, it's horrible.
I wrote something about it because I said, look, a price cap is never going to work.
No.
It's like they write a naked, huge call, and they're completely exposed to an extreme explosion of price if you have a cold winter. And then when people's payment, or basically invoices, went from, say, 200 euros a month to 600 or 800 euros a month, yeah, no one said, I'm going to pay for that. So indeed, it led to 20-25% reduction of demand.
Yeah.
And it was, for me, a perfect expression, good example of the purpose of price, yeah, is to bring back the market to an equilibrium.
Yeah, well, you have this old saying, best cure for high prices, yeah, is high prices.
It's high prices.
That's really true.
But do you think then that a price cap on any commodity is bad? Can we say that?
I think if it's done during the, really basically rewrite the rules.
Yeah.
And that's horrible because the rules...
You intervene in the market, right?
You intervene in this market. There are people having big positions and all of a sudden there's a price change. And that's never good for trust and that's never good for a market.
But import quotas, these kind of things, protectionism of farmers, is also kind of this intervening into markets, right?
Yeah, true. And there sometimes I do see benefits to support local economies,
yeah,
or economies that still have to grow, or local farmers, when you, yeah, make sure that you limit imports of meat or grains, and then the farmer will start to do it themselves. And that's in the long term has value. So there I do believe that sometimes it does work. Yeah. Yeah, but in this case, it was done on future markets, and I think it felt a bit panicky.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was the last thing that we wanted, I think, yeah, was more panic than there already was.
So what you see is the difference between a commodity trader who is pragmatic versus politicians who think about their voters, the next election. They feel like they have always the backing of the taxpayer and even some form of morality, yeah, and political drivers, which on the long term should not be done, right? And I find if you, for example, compare it in this space with the energy, it didn't make sense in light of, for example, climate change. Yeah? So on the one hand, politicians say, yeah, look, we need to reduce our emissions. And on the one hand, when there is finally a moment where you can stimulate people to use less gas at scale, they say, well, we're going to compensate you so that no one needs to reduce their energy uses, right? So those things, to me, they don't make sense. And that's why often when politicians come with regulations, they create turbulence or they create deficits. And that's also happening, for example, in West Africa with cocoa, where, for example, the Ghanaian government is always paying higher prices than what is justified by the fundamentals to get elected, but the country is bankrupt. So these things, they never work long term.
Yeah. Yeah, but there's a bit of a mix, and like you say, with physical markets or governments trying to, in the long term, make sure that it gets to a different kind of economical level, or for example, in the carbon emission markets, mm-hmm, which Europe has been quite successful in, mm-hmm, by making this political decisions that to tighten up this market, you get higher prices and therefore people start to produce, get the incentive to start to produce cleaner. Yeah. So there's also some value to this. But okay, I think in this case, it was done overnight in a panicky situation.
Yeah.
Whereas I think if you think about it and really explain why you're doing it, then yeah, it might make sense. Huh?
Look, and I think that if we translate it also to the financial markets, meaning the stock markets and the bond market, you see that in my mind, there is too much willingness to constantly regulate and to compensate for setbacks. If you look at, for example, the central banks, what they have done since 2008, we talked about 2008.
When I did not start at Osprey.
Yeah, and look, and I bought my house in August 2008.
Yeah, at the high, at that
2 time. 2 weeks before Lehman collapsed. Now, and since then, we experienced a long experiment of continuously lower interest rates that has till today dramatically inflated many asset classes, including the stock market, the housing market, And I think that we need to move away from that and accept normal economic cycles, like in the commodity markets. And you see that the commodity markets, they work over time to an extent that you do not have structural surpluses or structural deficits. And in the equity market, we don't need to ask for compensation by the Federal Reserve the moment we have a setback of 20%.
Yeah, no? True, but they're also part of a group of people that are a bit on the outskirts of things that might at that time not be able to weather these storms.
Yeah.
And I think there's a political role for governments to make sure that also these people are able to pay their bills or have food on the table. Because you know what happened last year or 2 years ago with the war in the Ukraine? Massive inflation, also food inflation, and really people dying or hunger in Africa.
Yeah.
And that's something what we have on the commodity side don't have a lot of influence on.
Yeah.
But it's still a negative side effect. And then you hope basically that governments would help or cap certain prices.
Yeah.
In these kind of markets where, of course, you have these black swan events and it's hard to trade. But therefore, I always love this question about an amazing trade and an awful trade. Do you have one or maybe two to share with us?
I thought about this and because I knew this question was going to come. I
think you can only recall the best ones, right?
I have a very funny one, which did not make a huge amount of money, but it did quite well. But it was basically based on nothing. So we had an analyst who found out that every quarter before three, crude oil prices would drop like a couple of cents.
And
we didn't know why. So me and another guy from my team, he said, okay, we don't know why this is. We are not really crude traded now. What do we know about this market? But okay, every day this happens and we look back at it and must have been some kind of oil major just hedging some of his physical production and selling some futures against it. So we said, okay, we don't know what happened, but we're going to just be in this trade every day. So at 240 every day, and we sold 100,000 barrels. And then we waited, and indeed, first week, prices dropped and I made some money. But we also said, okay, we're going to get out of this trade as soon as one day it doesn't work anymore. And of course, there was I think it was like 10th or 11th day, but it didn't work anymore. And at that time, of course, you lose the 10 days of profit, you lose four or five of them. In hindsight, it was one of my trades. I think it was very funny, but I think it also shows the analytical amount of data that people are processing these days.
Yeah.
And because this, we would have never have noticed when we were working for
it's such
for
a short time frame, right?
It's just a short time frame that there is this...
Amazing.
Yeah. So for me, it shows that the computer, the power of and the amount of data that people are processing these days is just immense.
Yeah.
Once a month, we have the USDA report that reports the USDA agricultural figures. Focuses on the US, but there's also reports on other countries. And in, I think in 0.4 seconds, 2/3 of the move is made. And so that quick. So they report the numbers at 6 o'clock. And at 0.4 seconds, 2/3. And these can be big moves. Yeah. And it shows that there's all these computers that are waiting and they're just grabbing the piece and without just seeing it, they look at the carryouts or the big numbers and they just sell or buy.
But that's why then I suppose you have very good Wi-Fi. Be very, very fast.
Well, that's what you see. You see some of these, indeed, like you say, these companies that move very close to this and with very big, what is
you
it?
You see it with bandwidth. The trading firms like Optiver and Flow Traders, they got their own, connections.
Yeah, it's not my game because I've never done it and it feels more like a technical advantage that you would have. But it also shows the size and the size of the amount of data that people are these days are being able to process and processing.
And how do you deal with that in the house? Because, you mentioned two names, well-known, and another one is Citadel. And like I said to you in preparation, Citadel is active also for talent. They managed to hire the best and the brightest PhDs, rocket scientists, you name it. They have a huge amount of capital. I can imagine that they trade the big commodities that are important and that we discussed, the big agricultural commodities that the house trades. And if you trade traditionally more from a fundamental point of view, how do you deal with the fact that these large players are active in those futures markets? Have you set up a different data science department or have you hired different types of people who can provide insights about the signals that these technical systematic traders look for? Or do you trust on your fundamental analysis?
No, I think the profile of the people has changed. Mm-hmm. So they're more with technical backgrounds and also at least familiar with technicals. But in the end of the day, I can't be in that 0.04 second. I will never play that game. So we have to be fundamentally right. Mm. And that is the whatever 150, 200 people that are looking at these markets every day. And there we have to do our homework so well. That's, we say, okay, days like the USDA reporting day, we could be completely wrong. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, fundamentals will prevail. And maybe fundamentally something changes. And then you have to be wise enough to get out of the way and just take your loss and start doing your homework again. Because that's, I think, one of the main good traits for a commodity trader, so being able to take his loss. Mm-hmm. It's because you know this market is going to go and hurt you more than you can imagine. We've all been in trades where first day we think, okay, this was a shitty day. Let's see tomorrow, because most of the pain is now probably done. And then the next day it starts to hurt even more. And so clear stops, clear targets.
How would you describe your own trading style?
Yeah, I would say very fundamentally. So that's the basic. But I'm also I'm never attached to the position. And I think that is basically the most important thing. Yeah. Don't fall in love with your position. Yeah.
Could you describe that a little bit more? Because we know what you mean, but this is a good example of how that works in practice for the listeners. So you have done all your homework with your team. You're convinced. Well, you've done the analysis, you've written the game plan, you execute, and then you go with your team. And then describe the mental process of dealing with the realization over time, or maybe looking at the P&L drawdown, whatever, that you have to get out. And then dealing indeed with this idea that you're not attached to it. But that is one of the most important, but I think for most traders also one of the most difficult things, to indeed not be attached to it. So what happens in your mind?
Yeah, well, it's like you say, the first thing is you've done all your work. You've done your homework. You convinced people why this is going to happen.
Yeah.
So you believe in it. And then when it doesn't happen, you basically think, I've not done my homework well. I'm not good at this, what I'm doing. What is going on? What am I missing? So the first thing is you look for the things why it should still work. And that's your first reflex.
Confirmation bias.
We should be long this product and look at this dry weather in Argentina. Of course we should be long this product. And you kind of disregard the good weather in Brazil. Mm. These kind of things. But that's something you should not do. The thing is, every morning or every time of the day, you should ask, okay, no position now, what would I do now?
Yeah.
And I think that is one of the most important questions you have to ask yourself. So would I still be this position knowing what I know now? Yeah. And if your answer is then no, then either you reduce your position or get out. Usually don't flip it, and because I think that is takes a bit of time to digest as well. Yeah. And otherwise you get whipsawed into on both sides. I think that's the main question people have to ask. Okay, would I do the same thing now, knowing what I know now versus what I knew yesterday?
I think the important thing here is not about your ego. And I think that when you look at online, for example, the way trading and traders are often shown, or in movies, it is about the ego. Traders that I know, including you and the way I worked with you, I never thought, look at this big swinging dick. That is not, and neither in on the floor.
But does it then change? Because look, you guys are obviously a bit older than I am. Mm. But do you think that you become a bit more relaxed when you get a bit older in the years of trading? Because maybe in the beginning you have a very ambitious, you're performance driven, and later on maybe you've been there, you've seen everything. Also, people know that you have proven yourself as a great trader, and then maybe you look things different. So therefore, maybe also for a team, it's interesting to have the both sides of the equation of years of experience, etc.
Yeah, I think it's...
Could that be?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's always good to have someone who has seen a bit more that is watching over the risk that you actually take or the position that you run. And you need young people or people who are aggressive, who want to put on risk and who want to show that they are the smartest in the room. But you have to also be able to tell them, okay, at this moment, you could be right. Yeah. But maybe this is not the right timing. And that's, you're right, it comes with a bit of experience, I think.
You become confident to not see yourself as weak when you get out of position. And you also get used to the idea, and you have had a confidence that you can bounce back. So this trade didn't work. Okay, fine. You get out. You go back to the drawing board. you are immediately open for all sides again. So you immediately are out of the confirmation bias. You start all over again.
But I think it's also nice because if you have young guys that come with all kind of arguments, like, yeah, we should do this because this and this and this, it also challenges you again for with coming with good arguments, why it's a good idea or not a good idea. And so it also, I think, keeps you sharp, keeps you on the edge, make sure that you keep being informed on everything what's going on in your S&D, in the positions, and outside of the office.
Yeah, no, true. And I think the best teams are also the teams that, you know, are quite diverse.
Yeah.
So you have a lot of different people. And I recall that we said, okay, why are there not a lot of women working in trading? I would love to have more women in trading because I think it would be great to have that angle. I'm not saying that it's necessarily completely different, not at all. But I think the more diverse the team is, the 100%. Better the final decisions become.
Yeah. Yeah, why, I think the diversity can help in all kinds of sides.
Now we touch base on that topic. Why do you think that there are not many women trading commodities?
That's a good question. I think it's maybe partly the image. It's a bit of, it used to be a bit shady. You have these people just throwing around money and just drinking and traveling anywhere. And then, so I think
Leonardo didn't really do a good job making it very popular maybe with the ladies.
No, I think that doesn't help. And I think it's also quite analytical. And I'm not saying that I think women can do that as well. But I think you tend to see a bit more women into more the softer.
Creative.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that is. And then I think it's also one attracts the other, right? Mm-hmm. So if you have 20 men on the floor and there's one girl comes in, then she would not necessarily feel very comfortable.
Yeah.
And it's not good. It's a bad thing.
Yeah.
But it is also what happens.
Yeah.
For example, I have a team in Vietnam and it's only girls.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Which is, I think, and it's great. And now I have one of these ladies. She will work in the Netherlands for 2 years.
Yeah.
And I think that is great.
That's really
And hopefully
cool.
I can rotate people.
But it's also a different thing that there's now the Erasmus University. Yeah. And I think in the US, you also have a university that started doing the study. It starts with that, right? There is no study. Everybody that we speak to ends up in the commodities world basically quite randomly. So yeah, if you have a study, then also I think you can get a much more diverse group because it's
you need role models.
Exactly. You need women. You need good women traders or risk managers to show people that this is actually a very interesting world to be in.
Yeah.
But I think maybe the good thing about things like happening in the Ukraine, which is a horrible thing by itself, but. Mm. People really start to realize that these commodity flows, it's not taken for granted.
No.
Where we've always been like, okay, everything was cheap, water, gas, we just turn on the tap and it's there.
It was there.
And now all of a sudden people start to, maybe in the future it's not so so common anymore and start to get more interested in it. Because I think, for example, water might be a very nice topic to be in for the next 25 years. I think
100%.
It'd be great.
Yeah. Yeah, you see it in Australia, water is a topic. You see it in South Africa, water is
China.
A topic. China. So it's 100% a topic. We see it as well when I talk to investors or when I talk to people outside. You get more and more people that get interest in this world of commodities, where in the past it was always somewhere in the background and do whatever you need guys to do, but make me chocolate and do. But it has so much more things behind what I think is key, because we all need food and we maybe can skip a washing machine or a television, but we all need to eat. So I think it's a key element to drive our world.
Yeah, I completely agree. And you also see the things that you also read in the paper, like batteries and being low on copper, or all of a sudden people are getting, they know, okay, my electrical car, my phone, this is also not taken for granted or less for granted anymore. So I think it's a good thing.
But the thing also is, if you look at what is important for the current, the young generations, they all talk about impact. In commodities, you have impact. What you do behind your screen gets boats and trains and factories moving, right? Yeah. Now, I saw a clip yesterday on LinkedIn about Citadel, and there were all women, pretty much all women. Yeah, so they're on the analytical side, and they were doing all kinds of smart stuff with Python. And so I thought, well, there are a huge amount of intelligent, ambitious women, but the commodity industry is less known than obviously Wall Street. Yeah, and you have a company which sits actually around the corner here. It's called Female X Finance, and they have, now they are in the business of promoting finance to women. But then this is focused on banking and M&A, real estate. I've been telling them, look, you also need to think about commodities. It's such an interesting job. It has become, I think, more sophisticated.
But I think the world of commodities is just very poor in basically marketing how cool it is. So that's just, we do our job. We all love what we're doing, but we're just not really advertising it really in a strong way.
Yeah, but that's the thing. I think once you know it, you don't understand that people don't like it. You have a lot of, or you have a lot of freedom. Yeah. You have a lot of responsibility. It's very international. You usually can travel a bit and understand other parts of the world. So it makes you also culturally, I think, a lot richer.
Yeah.
So you have all these good things, but people don't know it. Yeah.
Now, and for example, look, on investing and trading, you can find books, but not so much on commodities. Now, that's always something people want to know, the listeners or people I talk to. What types of books have you read, which basically enable to learn or be enthusiastic about certain things that you can recommend to our listeners?
Yeah, it's a bit of an open door, and I think already heard the word like Black Swan. I think that is a brilliant book. I think
The Lab,
yeah, exactly. That to me is a book.
I think you're the first one who says this.
It really explains, I think, risk very well, because traders very often look back, right? They focus on price history and price movement, and they have all these methodological things to forecast. Mm-hmm. And that's why we trade into this. We never go for the extremes, whereas in the extremes, there is most risk, but also most glory. Mm-hmm. But it's a horrible trade to put on, something that is out of that that bandwidth, because you basically lose every day, and one day you'll make a lot of money.
Yeah.
But for me, the part that I really liked about the book is that we as traders, we try to forecast things that happen. But these things, like the black swan, you cannot forecast.
Forget
the only thing is you have to be aware that there will be events, and there will be events that you get completely surprised.
Yeah.
And you just have to make sure that at that time, you either deal with it in the correct way, but also you manage your risk, and the risk is never out of hand.
Yeah.
So for me, that book was a very good example of, you know, that things that blow you out of the water, you will never foresee. But you have to be aware that these things will happen.
And now we had so many black swans events, big ones, really big ones, over the last few years.
I mean,
from COVID to the Suez Canal, supply chain issues, the wars. I mean, it's normally, I think there are much less of these events going on throughout the world. But
there is massive amount of black swans. And we cope with it relatively well. I think the world is so far coping relatively well with it. But if you think about these things that you've just mentioned, it's just... If this would have happened in the 90s or in the beginning of 2000, it would have been an event that would really make or break the year. And also now it's really having a big impact. But
you were stuck with your Nokia or maybe a BlackBerry for the ones that were a bit faster at.
Blackberries. So that was one of the books that I think was really impressive. And the other one was When Genius Fails. That is really a nice book. It's about a hedge fund in the States that the people that worked there were all geniuses. They had Nobel Prizes and so forth. They were
was
all
it Rentec, Renaissance?
No, it's long term.
Oh. That one?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, so, nice.
And they were all the brightest of the brightest.
Yeah, long term capital management, huh?
Exactly.
Okay, yeah.
And they had all these great traders, and they were really, but they also were very full of themselves because they thought they could not fail, basically.
Yeah.
Because they were all so bright that they couldn't even explain how bright they were to other people. But they made, I think, 40% return in investment for many years. Mm. So everybody wanted to invest in them. But at one time, they got so big, and then there was a black swan. I think it was the implosion of Russia in end of the 90s. And then the risk they had accumulated was so big that all the big international banks had to basically rescue them because they were too big to fail. And I think there was also, for me, the lesson is, even though you can be very certain of your case, the risk that you run is never to be underestimated because the markets will just tear you apart when 100%. Things go wrong. Yeah,
100%.
I think it's a good point. And when I see online people without doubt, I always think you can't be a trader. This is more like a gambling mentality.
Well, you never know 100%, right? So there's always doubt.
You need to have confidence in your judgment and in your hard work. You also need to have some form of skepticism and doubt.
Completely agree.
Agree. Well, with that, with two nice books and some good advice, we come to an end. And you see how fast it goes, right?
This is a black swan.
Yeah, exactly. This is quite a black swan, right? So you see, when you have
then
fun,
I see this coming.
It goes fast. So yeah, you see this coming. Sorry, guys. Again, creating a black swan event. Well, you guys could make an S&D again together. Ben, amazing for everything you shared here. I wrote some really nice things. I'm going to start my day now differently. I always start now with some very small kids and some diapers, but maybe now I can start differently. I'm not sure how my wife would think about it, but I can at least try.
The thing is, it for me, it really takes my phone and wake up and just look at it, 5 minutes, and I more or less have an idea of how the day will start.
Nice.
And of course, then the kids are there, and then the whole the real mess starts.
The real mess.
Yeah.
All the black swans.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice.
Now, in fact, I still do the same as well. My first thing is opening CNBC on my telephone because they have like a small ticker tape on the top where you can immediately see how Asia ended up.
Yeah.
You have oil, you have Europe, then you have the futures for the US. You even have the crypto casino. So then you know whether you're going to have a good day
or a bad day. Yeah, but also if there are shocks, we have to be careful about these kind of things.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. Ben, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you both. It was really, I really enjoyed it. Oh, thanks.
Very good.